guess our way is to begin with a prayer. We wanted to begin each of our sessions with a prayer from each of the traditions, a freestyle in a sense, non-coercive. Begin in Kabbalistic and Hasidic tradition. There's a tradition of communication not only among human beings, between man and God, woman and God, but also communication with other realms of other beings, angelic, but also even in this world, even birds, animals, to be able to understand the speech of birds, the speech of animals and other beings, in fact, all other creatures. This is a particular discipline that is practiced to this very day. And there's a story about one of the first generation of Hasidic students, Shneur Zalman of Liadi, the founder of Lubavitch Hasidus. Alon sung a song of Lubavitch Hasidism last night. This Shneur Zalman of Liadi wanted to learn the language of the birds. So he approached his teacher, the Magid of Mezrich, of Dovber of Mezrich, who was the great student colleague of the founder of Hasidism, Baal Shem Tov. And Rav Shneur Zalman asked the Magid of Mezrich, he says, well, please teach me the language of the birds. And the Magid took him out to the fields, and you know, they sat for a while, and they were listening, and so the Magid said, so do you get it? You know, do you get it? And Rav Shneur Zalman said, no, I don't get it. He says, listen, when you yourself understand what you're trying to say when you speak, then you'll understand what the birds are trying to say when they speak, and what all other creatures, by extension, are saying when they speak. And of course, when he says that, when you understand what you're trying to say when you speak, he's not just talking about the way we communicate in words, sort of decanting our words into the mind of another person. That's not it. He's saying, what are you trying to say when you speak? What is speech trying to do? In the Perek Shira, chapter song, we have a tradition to say a series of songs which are based on verses from the Bible. Each day has its own chapter. Today happens to be the third chapter, which begins, Ilanot shebesada omrim az yiranu atse haya'ar milefnei adonoi kivad ishpot et ha'aretz. The trees of the field say, then shall the trees of the forest sing forth before God when he comes to judge the earth. So even the trees sing. All creatures sing. All creatures pray. So what does that mean then? What is this tradition trying to tell us? In the verse in Psalms, from Psalm 69, says, Va'ani tefilati lacha Adonai et ratzon. Elohim barov hastecha, aneni be'emet ishecha. And I am my prayer to you, God, at a time of ratzon, of will, usually translated as goodwill, but really it's at a time of will. God, answer me in the truth of your salvation. For a human being, when we pray, it has to be va'ani tefilati. I am my prayer. We don't just pray in words. We don't just pray in the small actions of our being. We give ourselves in our own being as an expression of prayer totally and fully to God. Va'ani tefilati. I am my prayer to you, God. I am my prayer. And we ask God to answer the emet ishecha, in the truth of your salvation. And the word salvation is also connected to the word paying attention. all we really ask for God ever is, as we turn to Him in prayer, that He pay attention to us. His attention to us is a transforming truth. So I offer us for our session today just that verse from Psalms, which itself is a prayer. Va'ani tefilati lecha Adonai et ratzon. Elohim rov chasdecha aneinu be'emet yishecha. I am my prayer to you, God, at a time of will. God, in your abundant love, answer us with your true salvation. Switched off?
No, no, no.
Okay. If you have sheets that Therese was kind enough to Xerox and pass around, one sheet that begins with the title, I Pray with the Mind of a Child. Are we on yet? You blow a circuit. Speak again. You got a volume on that? Can you? Are you trying to get from the from loudspeakers? That's a different story. Now let's try. That's it. Okay. One of the questions that Alon asked me to put to you, and for us. A suggestion for us to discuss, perhaps, is with all of our interest and involvement in mystical prayer, do the practices or have the practices of mystical prayer in the traditions with which we are familiar become normative in any way? Are these practices that have worked themselves into a daily liturgy of the normal people who pray, you know, in congregations, in churches, in mosques, you know, in ashrams across the world, or just have these mystical practices in any way kind of rooted themselves in everyday practice? And to what extent? And has mystical prayer provoked any opposition? Are there those who are uncomfortable with some of the implications of a mystical prayer and prefer something much more straightforward, something simpler, something which they might perceive as more sincere? This is the question that we want to pursue a little bit. I want to look at this from the Jewish perspective. As much as there, you know, Kabbalistic prayer as it developed and mystical prayer in general, and the Kabbalists were not the only mystics in Jewish tradition. They were a mystical tradition and group that began, as I said, in the late 12th century. As much as there are those who are passionately excited about the potential for mystical prayer, it also provoked some opposition. And we're going to look at that today. When Kabbalah first hit the scene in the late 12th and particularly early 13th century, and its innovative qualities were recognized pretty early on, particularly this notion that God's revelation can be organized in a set of 10 principles, 10 sfirot, as we spoke about them yesterday. This provoked a lot of consternation.
The Jewish tradition is passionately dedicated to the oneness of God. And as Alon said yesterday, not just that there is one God, but that God is one in a oneness that is beyond the number one. As it says in the Sefer Yetzirah, the book of Yetzirah, before the number one, what can you count? Okay. We're talking about that kind of oneness. So what is this idea that God's revelation is somehow mediated in terms of ten sphirot, these categories? What are the implications? We mentioned yesterday that Rav Isaac Levine talks about the necessity of praying to God in finite terms, which we extend infinitely. And his point was that when we pray to God, each of the prayers of the fixed daily liturgy has a certain quality to it, and that quality is supposed to be evocative of one of the sphirot, or combinations of the sphirot. So for instance, in the first generation of Kabbalists, this is Rav Isaac the Blind's father, Rav Avram ben David of Pasquier in Provence, in the mid to late 12th century, he was of the opinion that when we pray, particularly for instance the Amida prayer, which is the sort of central prayer of the Jewish liturgy, that the first three blessings or benedictions of the Amida prayer are directed to God as the cause of causes, as the infinite, but that the middle section of prayers, which are petitionary prayers, are directed to God as he reveals himself as Yotzer Bereshit, creator of the former of creation. So in other words, in sphirotic terms, we begin our prayer to God the infinite, Ein Sof, as we begin to ask for our needs in the petitionary prayer, which is a controversial kind of prayer in itself, we can talk about, that's directed to God as he reveals himself in this area, these so-called lower seven sphirot, beginning here with love and judgment and mercy, these more morally thematic sphirot. And those middle prayers are directed here. And then at the end of prayer, which beginning of prayer is praise, middle of prayer is petition, we ask for our needs, the end of prayer is thanksgiving, that once again is directed to Ein Sof, to the infinite. In that middle section of petitionary prayers, each one of the prayers is focused on a different sphera. When we ask for wisdom, one of the first things we ask, so it's focused on the sphere of wisdom. If we're asking for forgiveness from sins, it's focused on this sphere of mercy, and so on, each one thematic. Now, can we turn that down? There's a little bit of an echo on this. Other Kabbalists of the time, particularly Rav Yaakov HaNazir, contemporary of Rav Avram ben David of Pasquier, had an even more radical perspective. His notion was that, and we'll be looking at this more in a subsequent lecture, is that our prayer never really is addressed to God as Ein Sof, as the infinite, but only to God as he reveals himself in creation and in revelation. And so in his opinion, the first three prayers of praise to God are directed to Bina, which is divine understanding, and that's that feminine nurturing aspect of divine revelation. And that the middle prayers, and this is an interesting innovation too, the petitionary prayers are directed to, in the daytime, to Tiferet, God in his sinful radiance or mercy in the daytime. In the nighttime prayer, it's directed back up to Bina or understanding. Okay. Even if we don't understand exactly what he's getting at, and we can talk about it technically, but I want to get into it technically, why he chooses those two. We see that in Kabbalistic prayer, prayer is directed to different aspects of God's revelation at different times. Okay. So not only are different prayers at different themes, but different times of prayer have their own different divine qualities, and it's constantly changing.
All of this provoked some significant opposition in the early 13th century. Besides, the Jews of the Jewish masses didn't even know where this was coming from. The Jewish rabbinic intelligentsia were very disturbed by this, and felt that this was in some way threatening a notion of the unity of God in some way. So what I want to look at is, this is actually a later response to Kabbalistic prayer, but it really sums up many of the themes these opposition themes. I think it's important always when we're looking at any phenomenon in a positive sense like mystical prayer, it's always good to look at the opposition. The opposition tells you an awful lot about the phenomenon you're looking at. It gives you, first of all, fresh perspective, if nothing else, and gives you a sense of its historical impact, of the phenomenon you're looking at, and really sometimes you can learn an awful lot about the phenomenon itself by studying the opposition. So this is what we look at today. We dedicate ourselves to the loyal opposition against Kabbalistic prayer. This that I have here is this sheet of paper, if everyone has, is an excerpt from what's called a tshuva, a rabbinic legal letter. It's a very popular genre of rabbinic literature from the 7th century until today. It's a very vital form of rabbinic literature. It's called She'ilot U'tshuvot, or responsa literature in English, responsa. The idea is that whether it's rabbis or laymen who are perplexed about some legal issue will write a letter asking a question to a great expert, a rabbinic expert, and he will respond, write a letter back addressing that point of law. This is actually a very precious rabbinic literary genre because, as opposed to very formally structured and premeditated literary works, here you have something that's very vital. It's a kind of living communication between rabbis and students, between laymen and rabbis, often reflecting kind of attitudes of life, details of everyday life. In fact, this responsa literature is a precious source of history for Jewish history. Now, I don't know, I assume that there are things like it in other religious and legal traditions. This is, as I say, quite vital to this very day. In fact, the internet has really expanded the possibilities of this rabbinic literature. You can now type in a little question to an expert, and you get an answer within a very short amount of time. Or people do that to me, for the things on which I'm an expert, and I'll be able to communicate it very quickly back and forth. So the internet has exponentially expanded the potential of this genre. So here we have responsum, this legal letter. Usually the subjects of responsa are points of law, ritual law, civil law, criminal law. Sometimes, though, they touch on more metaphysical issues or issues of faith, and that's what happens here. In fact, anything really is fair game for this literature. That's why it's so much fun. So the questioner here asked a particular rabbi, Rabbi Isaac Bar Sheshet, Yitzhak Bar Sheshet, known as the Rivash, who lived in the late 14th to the early 15th century, actually the mid 14th to early 15th century. His dates are 1326 to 1408. He was born in Barcelona, but traveled around in Spain quite a bit. And he lived in a very unsettled time in Jewish history in Spain. In his lifetime, the riots of 1391 broke out, a series of pogroms or riots that ultimate repercussion were the expulsion from Spain in 1492. This was the beginning of a period of tremendous unrest and danger for the Jewish community, and he himself had to flee Spain and ended up in Algiers. And that's where he settled, and actually was very honorably receive. He's a great authority in ritual law and in civil law and in criminal law. Jewish mysticism was kind of not his thing. Okay, and for that reason, actually, his angle on it is refreshing and interesting. So the questioner here appeals to Rav Yitzchak Bar Sheshet. And the questioner himself is perplexed. He sees that many people are beginning to pray in the Kabbalistic style, where their prayers are directed to one or another sphira at different points in the liturgy, at different times of the day. And he's asking, what is going on here? And what do you think of this? So Rav Yitzchak Bar Sheshet replies, and here you have the text as you have it in front of you. I wish to inform you that my teacher, Rabbi Peretz HaKohen, one of the great authorities of Jewish law in Spain in the 14th century, Rabbi Peretz HaKohen of blessed memory, would not speak of nor consider those sphirot at all. And that's a disparaging kind of, those sphirot, He wouldn't speak of this at all. I also heard from his own mouth that Rabbi Samson of Shinon, it's in France, he was the last of a great school of jurists known as the Tosafists, who was the greatest rabbi of his generation, and he says parenthetically, I too recall him, though I never saw him with my own eyes. He was the great authority of his time. He used to say that, quote, I pray with the mind of a child, unquote. It's a beautiful statement. And he did this in order to remove false doctrine from the hearts of the Kabbalists, who pray at one time to a particular sphira, at another time to another sphira, according to the theme of the prayer. Okay? That's pretty accurate. But so from the heart of the rabbinic tradition, we have opposition to this Kabbalistic custom. And I actually make a little bit of a parenthetical statement myself here. Kabbalah itself grew out of the heart of the rabbinic tradition. As opposed to some mystical traditions where mysticism is on the outskirts of the normative culture, Kabbalah grew right out of the rabbinic intelligentsia. So this is not some sort of flaky side phenomenon, an epiphenomenon in religion. It's really right, it's centrally located in Jewish tradition itself, but not embraced by all of the rabbinic culture. So Shimshon of Shinon opposed this. He did this in order to remove false doctrine from the heart of the Kabbalists. That is a strong statement. Lahotzi milibon shelha mekubalim. There's a hint there of heresy, that the Kabbalists are treading on heretical ground. Them's fighting words. Very strong statement. They say that this is the meaning of what the rabbis said. In other words, the Kabbalists defend what they're doing, because they say it's the meaning of what the rabbis said in the Talmud. Everyone goes back to the Talmud. That, quote, one who wishes to become wise should face south, to become wealthy should face north. It's from the Talmud tractate Bava Vatra. Does anyone know what that's referring to? What's this idea of facing any direction in prayer in Jewish tradition? Yeah, so if you're in the diaspora, when you pray, you face Jerusalem. If you're in Jerusalem, when you pray, where do you face? Towards the wall, towards the western wall. And originally, in Talmudic times, they had the Holy Temple. So all prayer was directed towards the Holy Temple. And in fact, not just the Holy Temple, but to the Holy of Holies in the Holy Temple. Wherever you live, and wherever you turn to pray, if you live in the west, you face east. If you live in Afghanistan, you'd face west, focusing towards the Holy Temple. And the Holy Temple itself had certain sacred furniture in it. It had a menorah, which represents wisdom, in the south, and a table of bread, which represents wealth in the north of the temple. And so the idea is, when you pray, if you're praying in a petitionary prayer for wisdom, face towards the temple, but inclined slightly towards the south, towards the menorah, towards the lamp, which represents wisdom. If you want, if you're looking for wealth, face slightly towards the north, towards the table, looking for riches. Okay.
So how is this a proof for the Kabbalistic idea of addressing your prayer to different spherot at different times? That's a little tricky, though. We're certainly only praying to God. So the question is, why should one turn in one direction or another direction slightly? And the shift, by the way, is very slight. We're talking about a few inches here or there, not even a few millimeters here or there. How could this be a proof for the Kabbalistic idea? Or we're not talking the menorah or the bread with table on, the table with the bread on it is not a spira. So what's the proof here? Yeah.
It just seems like it sets a precedent for there being more than one thing to do.
That's a nice way to say it. It's setting a precedent that there's in your prayer there's more than one theme. And you can express that focus on different themes and even in sort of different direction of your mind in prayer. You can express that by moving in different ways or by some distinctive intentionality. That seems to be the general idea. And he says, this means focus intent on the attribute of the right or the attribute of the left. And so now the Kabbalists interpret this custom of turning to the to wisdom or to towards riches, or towards, towards the menorah or towards the table of bread, as symbolically interpreted, sacramentally interpreted, as if you want wisdom, you turn towards the right, towards love, God's love and greatness. If you're looking for riches, you turn towards power and justice. So that's the world of finances. It deals with power and justice. Or the world of greatness and love for wisdom. So the Kabbalists project their symbol system onto the Talmud. Very, very typical. Okay. In the prayer of the 18 benedictions, which is the central prayer of the daily liturgy, they also have, for each and every blessing, an intention towards a specific sphera. It's accurate. Now he comments, Rav Yitzchak Bar Sheshet comments, all this is exceedingly strange in the idea in the eyes of one who is not a Kabbalist, who considers this to be a belief in polytheistic association. In other words, someone from the outside looking at this Kabbalistic practice of praying, and the way he's saying it, praying to a different sphera for a different need, I mean, praying to a sphera, even the language is shocking in Jewish tradition, to pray to a different sphera, this looks like a polytheistic practice, what he calls shituth, polytheistic association, associating other entities as being powerful along with God, which we do not do in Jewish tradition. So this is a strong charge of polytheism against these Kabbalists. He goes on, I have actually heard one of the philosophizers, the term philosophizer, hamitpalsafim in Hebrew, it itself is slightly disparaging. The Latin correlative would be philosophantes. Particularly in the 14th century, the development of and radical Latin averroism, there was a sense that some of these philosophers were amateurs, were getting kind of carried away, but without a solid foundation. They were called, and in Jewish tradition, the same thing was happening at about the same time. So they're called the mitpalsafim, those who have pretensions towards philosophy. Mitpalsafim, with the heat pile. So he said, I've actually heard one of the philosophizers speak disparagingly of the Kabbalists, saying, and with all due respect, present company, the Christians believe in the Trinity and the Kabbalists believe in the Decad. Okay, the set of ten and the set of three. Okay, they put them in company together. It's an interesting statement. This is exactly how he says it. So the idea is that this is something that actually can be
very intensely discussed what kind of similarities and differences there are in this notion of the Sefirot versus other notions of the way in which God reveals himself in different ways in other traditions, and how God reveals himself in a multiple sense. Okay, but this is a strong charge against Kabbalistic prayer and Kabbalistic practice in general. So now, having stated his basic opposition, he goes on to temper the issue. Second paragraph. It once happened when I was in Saragossa that the venerable sage Don Yosef Ibn Shushan, of blessed memory, arrived there. I had already seen him in Valencia. He was a Talmudic scholar familiar with philosophy, a Kabbalist and pious man of great stature, punctilious in mitzvot, in practice of divine commandments. He's a well-rounded intellectual, a well-rounded, spiritually committed person. Okay? Beautiful description of in many ways, an ideal rabbinic figure. Between us, there was great love and affection. I once asked him, quote, how can you Kabbalists, for one blessing, intend a specific sphira, and for another blessing, another sphira? Okay. Further, is there divinity in the sphirot such that a person should pray to them? Okay. Two very sharp questions. He answered me. And he answers at length here. Heaven forbid that prayer should be other than to God, may he be blessed, the cause of causes. Ilata ilot. It's a standard medieval phrase, an epithet for God as cause of causes. And it's God as the infinite. The matter, however, is like one who is involved in litigation and asks the king to arrange adjudication. He asks of him that he command the one who sits in judgment to judge him, not to command this of the minister in charge of the treasury, for such a request would be a mistake. You get his point, right? When you're asking the king for something, if you're asking the king to help you set up a court case, ask the king to tell the judge to judge your case. Don't ask the king to tell the treasurer to judge your case. Similarly, if you were to ask the king a grant of money, he would not say to him to command the judge to do this, but to command the treasurer to do this. Similarly, if he sought wine from him, he would ask him to charge the sommelier. If he sought bread, to charge the baker, and not the reverse. Such is the matter regarding prayer, which is always to the cause of causes, to God and his infinite being. It's just that one focuses thought to draw the effluence to that sphera related to the matter one is requesting. One would say that for the blessing, for the righteous, one should intend the sphira called chesed, that's the one called love or greatness, which is the attribute of mercy, not quite accurate, but close enough. And for the blessing against the sectarians, one should intend the sphira called gevura, the judgment against sectarians. So you focus on the sphira of power or judgment, because he's asking for strong judgment, the attribute of judgment associated with this. End quote. Okay. So how does Don Yosef Ibn Shushan explain this notion of praying using the Sefirot? He flips it around. He says you don't pray to a specific Sefira and sort of use that as an intermediary towards God, heaven forbid. But all prayer is directed to Ein Sof. And if you get graphic here, it's a always go to the top. Okay. But what you're asking for, your prayer goes to the top, but you're asking God, if you're asking for a petitionary prayer, you know, God, grant me wisdom through the sphere of wisdom. God, grant me mercy through the sphere of mercy. So the spherot are engaged only in the way down, so to speak, not on the way up, so to speak. There's no up or down here. But in other words, your address to God is direct. Your request is that whatever blessings come to the world should come through a particular sphera, and you're specific about which one it should be based on the theme of the blessing. That's how Don Yosef Ibn Shushan explains this idea of Kabbalistic prayer involving the sphera. Okay. The fear was, of course, that one approached God through a particular sphera. In other words, seeking mercy, pray through the sphere of mercy towards the Ein Sof. He says, it ain't so. That's not how Kabbalistic prayer works. Now, remember we talked about this yesterday. What's happened here is, with all due respect to these great rabbis, a subtle misinterpretation of what the original intent was of this idea of praying through the Sefirot. Rav Isaac the Blind, who lays down the basic principles, he's the father of Kabbalah, says you can't pray any other way than through the finite, because you're using words, concepts, and extend it to the infinite. He's not saying you can't relate to God. He's just stating the facts as they are. There's no other way in which the human mind works. He's being, frankly, quite phenomenological about it. He's looking at the way consciousness works. So this is not, and there's nothing heretical about that. It's just an honest appraisal of the of human mind. But as this was interpreted, and again, what happened is that Kabbalistic thought shifted from being quite experiential to being somewhat more doctrinal, from being an experience, you know, a mystical experience, to being a kind of theurgic process in which the interconnections of the theurgy were no longer apparent. Okay, and people, in other words, theurgy meaning action in the human plane, stirring up action on the divine plane. It was a loss of awareness of what the causality is, or what the connection is, in between human action and divine action. It was taken more as a doctrine than as a phenomenology. Now, if you lose that phenomenological or experiential focus, which was in the early, in the early generations of Kabbalah, and you look at this strictly as a doctrine, it does look shocking. Now, how can you say, I pray to God through mercy, to the infinite, when I'm seeking mercy? As a theurgic doctrine, it's heresy. As an experiential fact, it's the truth. That's the only way I can do it. I'm looking for mercy. That's what my, my mind is, I'm projecting that to God in his infinitude, but it's going through a finite channel. Okay. So once Kabbalah shifted more to a doctrinal theurgic system, the issue then, and the connection is between human action and divine action is stated as a fact but not understood in terms of its innerness, then the only way that you can interpret this and still be in line with Jewish theological principles is to say that one's intent must be directed to God in the infinite, and then hope that so like a candy machine, that the candy comes out in the right slot, so to speak. So that's how Don Yosef and Shishan explains the system. Yeah. That I wouldn't call that yet magic. I mean, that's just communication. That's a strong word to use, magical. I would use it sparingly. There's a real thing called magic, but I would use that word very sparingly. Again, if you're saying that we're no longer aware of the causality, and so we call anything which we have no, we're ignorant of causality, we call it a magical connection, maybe. But I mean, here it's just communication. I'm talking to God and saying, God,